welcome Rabbi Brander to give the contemporary halacha shiur about preparing a home and a community for Pesach. Before Rabbi Brander came to yeshiva, he was actually a shul rabbi for many, many, many years. So he's going to share with us his experience to help prepare us when we become rabbis ourselves.
Okay. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Rabbi Rowan. There's two sets of handouts. One very small one. You don't have one. Okay. So, our goal to what time do we have, Rabbi?
2:30.
Our goal to 2:30 is to deal with a whole bunch of different issues. And what you have in front of you is a handout as Chametz sale contract that I used to use that now my colleague Rabbi Goldberg uses in Boca. I want to go through it with you. And a collection of different materials that I put together for you in a handout that I actually also used in my class on successful synagogues. And I just want to go through a little bit of an overview with you of that. The first and most important thing that is important to prepare for you regarding issues of practical halachas of dealing with Pesach is, I think, the most important challenge that happens on Pesach is one that you may not be aware of when you're a Rav, or may not be aware of as you prepare for becoming a Rav, and that is the Shalom Bayis issues that sometimes Pesach, Zman Cheruseinu, creates for us. And that is sometimes there's tension in families because of pressures, both time and of course. And if you think a family is having difficulty paying their food expenses during the rest of the year, that Benoshel Kavachomer paying their food expenses on Pesach when, you know, poor man's bread is at $20 a pound, it becomes a little bit more of a challenge to pay for it. So the first thing is about a Rav being proactive in the Kimcha to Pischa type of responsibilities. And if you know of families that you think are going to have challenges, there's nothing wrong with meeting with either the couple or one of them, depending on which one you feel most comfortable having the conversation with, and saying, listen, I know it's hard before Pesach, here's a loan, and give them $500, $250, $1,000, depending on where the family is, if you have that money in your discretionary fund, or give them a card, to a local grocery store that's like a gift card, and allow them to use it, and, you know, view it as a loan, tell them they can pay it back whenever they want, or they don't have to pay it back at all. And basically take out the embarrassment about them having to have the conversation and perhaps obviate some of the problems that there may be regarding the issues of Shalom Bayis, which is probably the most important job that a Rav could do at the end of the day. That's one issa daraisa, or one issue of a daraisa issue that we even are mochek shem Hashem in order to try to deal with, that you'll be able to deal with if you deal with it proactively. The other thing is sometimes time, and I think we have to remind people that chametz cleaning and spring cleaning are not exactly the same. And while sometimes it's heroic what people do in order to prepare for Pesach, it's not always necessary. So taking a toothbrush and cleaning, you know, between the strips, the plastic strip, the accordion strip in the refrigerator, in order to make sure there's no dirt there, it's not a halakhic requirement. And washing it down nicely with a little caustic agent will make sure that if there's any food in that accordion strip, it will be obviated. But to sit there for an hour with a toothbrush, which I've seen people do, maybe spring cleaning, it's definitely not a halakhic requirement in Pesach cleaning. And again, when couples have challenged, when most families, due to the challenges of living a Torah lifestyle, require two-income homes, adding that additional types of pressure are things that you can obviate. So sometimes the first responsibility may be to get up there between Purim and Pesach and just say, hey, listen, I'm not here to be mako on the laws of Pesach. I'm here to be machmir on Shalom Bayis. Let's just remind ourselves what we need to do and what we don't need to do in order to be prepared properly. If that is all we talk about between now and 2:30, Hareza Meshubach, that is more than enough. Making sure that Shalom Bayis issues are dealt with in a very pragmatic and practical way. The second issue that I'd like to bring to your attention, and again, you'll have different shuls. Some of you will have shuls like I had initially. I didn't have any secretarial help or anything else of that nature. Then as your synagogue or as your positions grow, they go have secretarial help. How do you use your secretary when it comes to issues like this? The rabbis then get inundated with calls. I remember fondly one loving story. You know, Boca is nestled between some senior communities. I remember somebody calling me around 12 o'clock at 11:30 at night, asking me a question of how to kosher a vessel. And then after I answered the person, I asked them, I said, Mrs. So-and-so, just out of curiosity, why did you call me? Your son and I went to smicha together. He's a rabbi. And her response was, I would never call my son that late at night. Right, you know? And so you will get those phone calls, those emergency phone calls at 11:30 at night on how to kosher a fork. And sometimes the role that you allow your secretary to play, but not as a posek. I remember the secretary that I had, actually, she had gone through certain cancer treatments, and so therefore she wore a shetel. And when Rabbi and Rebbetzin Schechter came, one of the many times that they came, Rebbetzin Schechter was having a conversation with the secretary about where she bought her shetels. And started to have a conversation, and Rebbetzin Schechter was using a lot of Hebrew Yiddish lingo, and she wasn't Jewish. In fact, I sold her my lechametz for the community. She had been part of the infrastructure of the community for so many years. She could handle the conversation without any challenges. Right, I only told Mrs. Schechter afterwards that she wasn't Jewish. But the bottom line is that how you use your secretary can be a big help. So, for example, someone's going to call you and ask you, you know, how do you kosher, or call your secretary, how do you kosher a self-cleaning oven, how do you kosher a microwave, how do you kosher this. Hopefully you've written all of that down for them, or you've cut and pasted it from a whole bunch of different places. There's nothing wrong if your secretary says, you know, the rabbi has written this down, and I can send it to you, I can email it to you. Would that be sufficient? That's one less phone call that you need to deal with. And I'm not suggesting that phone calls aren't important to deal with. I think they're important to deal with. I'm just saying you're going to see that there's going to be a lot of stress and tension right before Pesach, and a lot of Rabbanim actually get physically sick right before Pesach. The Shabbos Hagadol Drasha, all the questions, your own responsibilities at home, and depending on which communities you live in, sometimes there'll be a mass exodus before Pesach, and sometimes there'll be a tremendous amount of people coming before Pesach, so you get some additional responsibilities. So I'm just mentioning that's the role of a secretary, not to delegate, you know, difficult shilas to, but answering some standard or just simply being able to send emails for you and stuff like that could be very helpful. All right, those were the non-halachic introductions. But now let's move to looking through. Let's start with the getting rid of chametz in general. So getting rid of chametz in general. Mechiras chametz, the bayirah, bayimatzah issue, how it's done. You can burn it, you can either burn it, you can throw it out. I'm actually serving as the interim posek for the Kesher Israel community, Barry Freundel's old synagogue and old mikvah. And one of the challenges they have this year is they don't have anyone to do bir chametz in their community. And they want, and it's Washington, it's greater Washington area, you just can't, you know, just can't just create a little fire, you know, spitting distance from the White House. Unless you're part of the Secret Service, then maybe you can do it. But other than that, you can't. So they actually asked me that this year they don't have the wherewithal to do it. Can they just simply, how do they deal with the remnants of the chametz? So I actually told them they can, you know, is the machlokas tanayim, exactly, can you burn it, can you throw it out, whatever. But the bottom line is, you can be yotzei by simply just dumping it down the toilet. I think it's better to burn it, but in that case, I told them they can just throw it out that way. But the Shulchan Aruch discusses in Tafnan Ches and in other places, the Hefsid Merubah issue, can you do anything for Mechiras Chametz? Because we also have a problem, especially in Tafnan Ches, it discusses Chametz She'avar Lo B'Pesach, discusses the whole idea of giving to a guy Chametz as a Matana Gemura. But after many years, as the Shulchan Aruch discusses in Tafnan Ches, Sif Gimel and Dalet, with the Mishnah Berura really elaborating upon the laws about Mechiras Chametz in general. And so let's deal with the laws of Mechiras Chametz. So in order to deal with the laws of Mechiras Chametz, I want to point out two important documents for you, and that is the rabbi serves as an agent for his congregants. You don't sell the chametz to the rabbi. The rabbi serves as an agent, and the expert in Mechiras Chametz, maybe in the Jewish world, is Rabbi Willig. So for me to discuss this in great depth with Rabbi Willig is, you know, down the block, so to say, or around the corner, is a little bit an act of hubris on my part. So I'm just giving you a basic overview. The rabbi serves as a shliach. He makes a kinyan, authorizing the rabbi to sell on behalf of the congregant the chametz to a non-Jew. Shlichus is done better with a shtar for a few reasons. Number one is it's a more powerful experience. And number two is it means that you're taking it more seriously. And so I'd like to, if you can turn to page 7 of the large handout, I'd like to actually just review with you one shtar so that you get a little bit of an overview of this shtar. This is a shtar that I wrote many years ago that my colleague Rabbi Goldberg uses right now in Boca. And so I'm obviously familiar with it. So here, this shtar, basically, the congregant fills it out. I, let's say, Kenny Brander, do hereby authorize Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg to sell my chametz. There's an address, there's a city, there's a state, there's a phone number, there's a cell phone number, an address. Or in any other places, for example, he has children or she has children in YU or Stern or somewhere else, and or, you know, somewhere else, and you want to put those places down. Locations of the chametz, the real value of the chametz, real value of the liquor. And if you're going away for Pesach, you want to be able, the guy should have entry to his chametz. And therefore you want him, the rabbi should really have access on behalf of the guy to be able to get to his chametz. So therefore it's really important that, and this does not be a total joke, and not be a joke at all, and therefore the family needs to leave over a place where they have keys. I had like, you know, 2 dozen keys of different people, or their codes to their side doors, so that a person could have, the guy could have access. I made it my personal protocol that every single year, the guy we sold the chametz to visited one home. And everybody knew about it. Everybody knew it. Now, the first place I had them visit was my home, so they shouldn't think I picked on someone else. But the bottom line is, they'd visit my home, and they would visit someone else's so they could indulge in the chametz they own. It becomes the hock around the table, which is much better than the other hock that will be around the table. And it really shows that you're treating the Mechiras chametz with some seriousness. So I think it's something, I wouldn't call the person in Israel saying, I'm having the guy visit you, so please, I'm going to use the key, go into your house, please tell me the alarm code and everything else like that. I don't think you have to go that crazy. But the bottom line is, let people know that this is serious. The most important part of this form, in addition to what we just said, is time zones. So let's play this out. Again, I don't have this on the top of my head, but let's just make it easy. Let's say the Isser of Achilas Chametz, the Isser of having Hana from Chametz, is at Erev Pesach. Let's say it's at 12 o'clock. Right? It's not the time, but let's just make it the time for our conversation. And the family's in Israel at 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock, depending on the time of the year, depending on how the clocks are going. There could be, you know, in the middle of Maariv, you know, or middle of their Seder, and you're selling their chametz. You can't sell their chametz when there's already an Isser Hana by them. You have to sell the chametz when there's no Isser Hana for the people that you're selling the chametz on behalf. So you have to make sure that when you sell the chametz, you are selling the chametz at a time in which the people you are representing still have the capacity to not be over by your rabbi or matzah, and they're the true bailim of their chametz. So therefore, you have to sell your selling of chametz will happen at different times. You'll sell your chametz to the non-Jew. Let's say, again, the Isser of Hana starts at 12 o'clock. You'll sell it before then. Let's say you'll sell it, you know, before there's an Isser, you know, before when the Isser of Achila starts, you'll sell the chametz. Let's say, again, I'm using round numbers to make it easier for the conversation. Let's say the Isser of Achila is at 11 o'clock, so let's say you sell it at 11 o'clock or something like that. you sell it at 10:30, or you know, before the Isser Hana takes place, but you need to sell it the night before for the people who are in Eretz Yisrael. And when you buy back the chametz, the people in Los Angeles, it's 3 hours early, you have to make sure that you're setting it up in a structure in which you're buying it back for, on behalf of those people, but not while it's still Pesach for them. And so therefore you have to make sure that they understand how exactly you're calibrating this. So by the fact of indicating the different time zone, you first of all create for yourself different piles of these forms. I would color code the forms based on the things. You know, I would just put a, I would put a mark on the top of it, and I would create different forms, different folders based on the different forms. And look at what it says here. If you're in a different time zone and you have your chametz with you, consider your chametz sold effective when you wake up Erev Pesach, and do not consider the chametz bought back or owned by you until the morning after the conclusion of Pesach. This way, basically, you create this overall arching thing that essentially, other than the chametz that you're buying for yourself in Eretz Yisrael, or other the chametz that has nothing to do with your Mechiras chametz solution here, you, the rabbi is basically making it safe for both you and as he is your shliach, to make sure that no one's over any significant isurim. And then you sign the form, etc. There are always people who wait till the last minute. It just happens all the time. No matter how much prep, no matter how many times you leave yourself open for selling chametz, it's just going to happen. And therefore, having a fax or having an online form just allows you to basically deal with the issue a little bit better. So again, on the bottom of page 7, of this handout, you'll see there's a there's an online form as well as a fax number that it can be sent to. And even though it says it's best to send it before Thursday, April 2nd, because you're going to sell the chametz right on Friday, you want to just make sure that you check your fax machine as well as the bin in which these emails are coming to make sure that any remnant emails are also put into your batch that you're selling. Okay? And then, of course, you say, please call the synagogue office to make sure we've received your form. That's a very nice thing to do, but you should still check anyways. Okay? That's the form in which, that's the form that you have the Jew fill out to, again, you are not selling, the rabbi is not buying everyone's chametz. He's the agent for the congregants. He's the broker. The rabbi makes a kinyan that authorizes the rabbi to sell chametz to a guy. And again, as I said before, I think the best shlichus is when it's concretized in a shtar. So that's the first piece of this. And then what happens is the document that you sell the chametz to the non-Jew. And it is important, and the Mishnah Berurah actually goes through this very nicely, that there are multiple kinyanim. Since we're not sure exactly which kinyan works, we try to do all of them. Chalipin, the shaking of hands, chatzer, the kinyan agav, and kesef. There's a question whether some of the kinyanim only work by men, or some of the kinyanim only work by women, so non-Jews. So you do every single kinyan distinctly, and therefore you basically cover yourself by all those kinyanim. That issue is actually highlighted in this document, which is a translation of the Hebrew document. It's much easier for everybody to read. So we will look at this document. And again, if you want a copy of this document in an email form, so that you have it for yourself and you just change the relevant... I didn't even change the dates for this year. You just change the relevant dates. You can just email me and I will send you a... Word document of this. This is one of these forms that it pays for you to have in your, it pays for you to have. Or I can send it to Rabbi Orlian and he can send it around. Let's go through this form. Agreement made on April 14th, 2014, corresponding to whatever, before 12:30 Eastern Time between Rabbi Goldberg of Boca Raton Synagogue, hereafter referred to as the agent, and Kerry Purcell of Boca Raton, who's again a one of the secretaries in the synagogue who's not Jewish, whereas certain persons whose names are set forth upon certain inventory sheets delivered herewith to the buyer. Those inventory sheets are these. That's these sheets. These are inventory sheets. And all I do is I just simply put them in a folder. I have a folder of these sheets. I make two copies, one for the non-Jew and one as me as the representative, so I have a set also. Delivered herewith to the buyer, herein referred to as sellers, are desirous of selling all chametz as hereinafter defined, owned by them, and which they have interest whatsoever, any interest whatsoever. And whereas each of the said sellers has designated and appointed and empowered Rabbi Goldberg as their lawfully designated agent to sell, transfer, and dispose of all such chametz, such matter, and upon such terms as said agent in his sole discretion shall deem appropriate. And whereas the buyer here and above identified is desirous of purchasing all the said chametz of the sellers in accordance with the terms of this agreement. Now therefore it is agreed upon by and between the agent as agent for the sellers and each of them and the buyer that the agent hereby sells and the buyer hereby purchases all chametz belonging to each and every one of the persons herein referred to as sellers whose names are set forth upon the individual inventory sheets of each seller. Now here's where it gets important. The term chametz is intended to include all leaven products, etc., etc., etc. Alcohols, next sentence, any of the above mentioned products, including but not limited to all items specifically enumerated upon the individual inventory sheets of each seller. In order to effect the sale, the buyer agrees to pay the agent the sum of the estimated fair market value of all the chametz as determined by three recognized experts according to the accepted market value pervading today in Boca Raton, Florida. When you borrow the sheet for your own community, switch the city and the personality, and which shall be paid by the buyer as follows. 50 cents per person right now. It's a full sale. It's just, one second, let me just go through this. 50 cents per person. And the rest on or before April 23rd, you know, right after Pesach. The understanding is that the sale is absolute and effective immediately, and that the balance is considered a debt from buyer to seller. Because if it wasn't, if it was just a down payment and the sale was going to happen afterwards, everyone in your community has been over by your rub, by your matzah, right? The non-payment of which shall in no way affect the validity of the buyer's title to the chametz sold, risk of loss of value are borne by the buyer. Okay? That's an important issue for the buyer to understand. So if there's a hurricane or something like that, even though they don't really happen in April, you know, there's a piece here that's important to know. In addition, the buyer gives an item, so there's first one kinyan of kesef, an item of personal property to the agent, known as chalitin, right? So that's another kinyan, the kinyan of chalitin. And here, the person who is doing the action, namely the non-Jew, gives you the item, and you do a kinyan of chalitin with them, and when you buy it back, it would be the rabbi who is uses his object. And they shake hands in accordance with the customs of sales, known as simtuta. These additional methods of acquisition are employed because of the questions about the effectiveness of each method. And we don't write the questions of each method for a non-Jew, right? It is emphasized that each sale method of sale is independent and therefore unaffected by any invalid sale or method of sale performance in this agreement. It is further agreed that the agent, in behalf of each of the sellers, or on behalf, hereby leases to the buyer the closets, cabinets, storage rooms, this is, you know, the other kinyanim that we discussed, garages, basements, etc., 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 so that there is now a different kinyan that is being done here. Next paragraph. In consideration for the foregoing rental provision, the buyer agrees and hereby does pay to the agent the additional sum of 50 cents for each of the enumerated sellers. In addition, the aforementioned methods of exchange and handshakes are used to effect the rental. So, right, yes. Kinyan Chatzim, correct. Which is going to be mentioned right now. By dint of the execution of this rental agreement, the buyer also requires ownership of all four square chametz, which is thereby transformed to him in the best legal form, a kinyan agav. Further, by the virtue of the buyer's rights in those rented storage areas, as Rabbi Orly just mentioned, all chametz contained therein is acquired by the buyer by a kinyan of chatzer, etc., 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 signed Shalom Yisrael. So you do these kinyanim twice for the for the actual food as well as for the location. And the non-Jew gives you a payment for it, and then you go. What I did is you go to the non-Jew right after Pesach. You ask if you have this conversation. The non-Jew indicates that he or she is not interested in finds themselves in a position where they don't want to continue the sale. You offer to buy it back. I offer to buy it back at a little extra rate than has been determined. I have this all tallied up. I have the inventory sheets all tallied up. You know, what they say the cash is worth. So it's in the neighborhood normally of, $100,000, give or take, at least, depending on which community you live in. And you look at the liquor amounts, they could be much more serious than that. But the bottom line is that this is what, and you offer to buy it back, and you go through the whole process again. You go through the process of chilipin, you give the money, you go through the process of chilipin, you don't have to do a chutz or anything else like that, you just do a handshake, and you buy it back. I then will buy it back. I will then have a similar conversation actually very late at night for the California people, or very early the next morning, depending on where the time zones are, but normally just very late at that night, and buy back that group. So the Israelis, basically, their chametz is being bought back much later than it needs to be. But for the Americans, for those in America, it's being bought back at the right time. The first person I normally call after I buy back the chametz is the people who own the pizza shops, so that they can immediately start prepping their dough, in return. The rabbi's family gets the first pie, and paid for, of course. But the bottom line is that that's an important phone call to make for the, because the community has been starving themselves from pizza for a whole 8 days, and that's the way it goes. Now, sorry, there were a few questions.
I have two questions now. So I understand that I don't assume the secretary of the Roberton Synagogue is that wealthy.
Actually, her husband was very wealthy.
Oh, really?
She had the wherewithal to do it.
So that's why.
Yeah. This one. It depends how you want to do it. Yeah, so do they actually have the wherewithal to do it or not? The one I used actually had the financial wherewithal. She didn't have to work. She wanted to work.
Right, but
different people do different things.
So it's not always, but since it's phrased in this contract that it's pretty much a scipus nova, like there's everything else that she's going to own as a loan, so would there theoretically be a problem of...
No, because she could borrow the money from someone. She has a house. She can take a second mortgage on the house without a problem. She can get other people to...
No, but like, would she really want to be buying? If they're not... you said she's wealthy and stuff.
Yeah, I think it's important to find a non-Jew who has the capacity to do this, has the financial capacity to do it. The one I always worked with had to, again, often made more donations to the synagogue than she received as a paycheck. I think it's best to find someone who has the financial wherewithal to do it.
Okay, and my second question is with regards to the Kinaga.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand what it says also with the subleasing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know, for example, like I'm in the dormitory, I don't know if I'm able to sublease what I have, so then is there any way to circumvent that?
I officially have my formal job right now. I'm the vice president in charge of the dorms and stuff like that. So go for it.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think it... I think what YU sells their chametz, but we also sell the chametz also here. So we're selling all of the chametz that we would find anywhere also. But regarding your specific chametz, I think you have a right to sublease it for this thing. Yeah, I don't think it's a problem.
I said yesterday that
right. Right. He actually has a tape that he says that in. Because before I gave the shiur, I just wanted to read these halachas. I wanted to review a little bit more. So not only did I read through Taf Mem Ches, but I actually went through Ray Wilson's thing. So he actually has something from 2-3 years ago where somebody asked him the exact same question. But I don't think it's an issue. On behalf of Yeshiva University, as a person in charge of the dorms, right, I'm telling you that was never our intention. So if you want to sublease it and a non-Jew wants to go taste your chametz and thing, let them send me an email and we'll make sure that they can go to your dorm room and enjoy their chametz. Yes?
Is there a
Is there ever an issue after Pesach where the man says, "Oh, sorry, I'm, you know, out to dinner with my husband, and you know, I'm not available"?
First of all, you can probably do this all over the phone, you know, if you have to. Secondly, you know, I always make a time before Pesach, schedule time with them on Pesach. I mean, I schedule the time for after Pesach to do this. But I assume that if you have no choice and you had to do it over the phone, the person said he didn't want to continue it, you couldn't do all the kinyanim that way, but you could at least do some of the kinyanim that way.
Like what?
You know, you could... There's money owed. Right. No, you couldn't do the chatzer. You could do the money piece. But you work it out with the non-Jew before. I've done this for 20 years. I've never had a case like that. And, you know, if God forbid the non-Jew goes into the hospital or something else of that nature, you know, you can go to the hospital and just do it there. There's always...
Or just don't eat.
What?
Or don't treat, not to drink your liquor. For
yeah, that's a little harder to do, but the bottom line is you schedule a time, and normally, you know, I have never had a case where that didn't work if you schedule a time. To call them right after Pesach and say, "I'm ready to come over right now," is a little irresponsible and could lead to some of the things that you're just saying. But if you set up a time in advance, then you just go over there and you make it your responsibility of doing it right away. You just deal with it right away. By the way, it does say honor rest before a certain date. So the bottom line is, if they don't pay that by a certain date, there's one piece that does get canceled automatically, albeit not with all the other kinyanim. Yes?
Last year I went to the sale in Riverdale. All my eyes were there.
Yeah.
So the shlichus became sort of complicated because some of the rabbis give their contracts to other rabbis to sell for them. So how does that work with the form?
So I would do, like, in Boca, we had certain cases where some of the rabbis actually got to a point where some of the conservative rabbis actually wanted me to do it for them. So I actually worked out at different times, either I had them actually come to the thing also and go through the whole process, or I would then change this form up a little bit, and I would write it up in a way that I, let's say, Rabbi Brander, representative of all the congregants of congregation, fill in the blank, do hereby authorize Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg to sell, transfer all chametz, whatever, and I would change it of all those who I've asked to represent, and I would change this thing. Okay, that's what I would do. I would change this around a little bit. Okay? Yes?
How do you do the valuation of the chametz?
I ask them what they think the chametz is worth. I mean, they have a better understanding of the value of liquor than I do. So most people are proud to say how much their liquor is worth. So it's not, if anything, they've over-exaggerated, not understated it. Right? Yes?
Making the sale, you say it's 50 cents per person right now. Where's that number coming from? Why that number?
There's no. It has to be at least a pruta. A 50 cents, it's a round number. It's good to work with round numbers, right? Depending on the silver valuation, it's probably pennies don't work, you know, and stuff like that. Again, 50 cents, you're never going to have to worry about it. It will always work. So you use 50 cents, and you just it makes it much easier on a calculator to work the things out, and that's what you do. You have 100 people times 50 cents, you know what it is. You have 1,000 people times 50 cents, you know what it is. Call it a day. What?
It's a dollar, no? Because it's additional 50 cents for yes. The
person.
Yes,
per kinyan. Okay. Right. Next question, because we got a lot more to do. Okay, so let's go on. Okay. Let's remind ourselves again, places where you last time you walked into was to clean for last Pesach. You don't need to clean again. So, for example, you know, if you don't keep chametz in your garage, or if that's not a place where you normally frequent, you don't have to clean that place. You know, crumbs that are not edible to a dog, you don't have to worry about. So, you know, going behind your oven to clean everything and like perfectly clean, I'm not sure that's totally necessary. If you want to put some bleach down there, harayza mishubah, and you're okay. But the bottom line is, you know, you don't have let's make sure that we don't make Pesach cleaning into spring cleaning. Want to make one other comment about the sel chametz form? That's not a halakha comment, but it's just a pedagogic, rabbinic comment, and that is, and I want to make it clear that this is something that I did, and my colleague Rabbi Goldberg has followed my direction on this. Was I didn't take the money from Pesach for myself. I used that money to create a fund to send kids to day school. And anytime there was financial issues with day school education, this was the beginning of a fund. By no means it was the complete fund, but it became the beginning of a fund. Now, I shared this with you for two reasons. I shared this with you for the reason that it is a really nice thing to do, to create a fund on something that you're interested in, whether it's day school education, whether it's something for Israel, whether it's something within your own synagogue that's good, something to do. I share it with you for another reason, that is, that depending on your salary structure, you shouldn't be doing this, but you should be doing what other people have done in the past, and that is that money can be used for the rabbi. There are different communities that do it in different ways. There are different communities where the rabbi receives this money. I always felt a little uncomfortable about doing that. I just was a little uncomfortable about it. There were a few congregants who said, I know, rabbi, that this money all goes for the rabbinical discretionary fund or for thing, but I grew up that the money always went to the rabbi, so here's a check for the discretionary fund, and here's a check to do something with your kids. So when they did something like that, which didn't happen that often, but happened a little bit, so I didn't go over crazy. I thanked them very much, and I separated the two amounts. But I made it clear to everybody that the money here was about scholarships for Yeshiva day schools. I also used this time to connect with congregants that, let's just say, didn't go to Minyan three times a day, okay? Or that needed a little spiritual, you know, connection with. Because they're going to come to sell your chametz, even if they're not totally Shomer Shabbos, even if they're not totally connected, even if they're speaking badly about you around the Shabbos table, they're coming to sell the chametz. Use that opportunity. So I actually had much longer hours for selling the chametz than was really required. Because I actually, unless the line got really long, I actually used that time as, I would say, you know, 7 to 10 minute pastoral interactions. Haven't seen you in a long time, how things going with your son here, how this, what's going on, you know, whatever, maybe you can come, you want to come to my house for Shabbos one time, our house for Shabbos, Rookie and I would love to have you for a Shabbos. But, you know, those opportunities where the person's not really been connected with your shul. Now, and this is an opportunity. Don't minimize the opportunity that Mechiras Chametz can do to clean out the chametz not only in the house, but the chametz that the Bali Kabbalah speak about in the soul and in the heart, and the capacity to deal with that chametz, which has, you know, redemptive components to it also. So I would very seriously encourage you, you know, to think about that from a, you know, in a very serious way. Okay. All right. Now let's go through the next thing. We're going to go through kashering for Pesach. Now, there are a few pieces here that are good. If you turn to page 5 of this handout, I just want to show you the pages first. I would ask you not to read it right now because you're going to get lost in what I want to do with you. Page 5 of the handout just is a little bit of an overview of how to kosher. And then if you look at page 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, this is copied from the CRC website. It's a little bit of an overview of koshering, but the nicest piece is on page 20, page 21, where they have nice charts about koshering everything. It's a very easy way of just giving people that thing. So this handout is made out of my own personal Boca Raton Synagogue experience, but also the CRC and the Star K websites, which the OU website's also very good. The Star K and the CRC are wonderful websites on kashrut stuff, and therefore I cut and pasted a little bit from all three of them in this thing. Okay? And we're going to go through the cleaning processes, but I wanted to point out these pages, page 5, and then page 17 through 23. Again, I ask you, let's not read through it right now because I want to go through it with you pretty fast and see if you have any questions on this, and then this is for you to take home. If you're having difficulty sleeping at night, there's more than enough things here to help you with that challenge. Okay, let's go through. How can one kasher? Let's go through the halachas of kashering. We're not going to go through every single piece because we only have 45 minutes left and we have a few other things to do. There's libun, right? And there's two forms of libun. What are they? There's libun gummer, which is really heating metal till it glows. It's like a form of incineration. And there's a libun kal, heating it to the point where, you know, a piece of kash or a piece of paper, you know, would burn. There's hagala, which is purging. There's ilui roschim, which is purging through hot water pouring. And there's milui v'irui, and that is a soaking process of some type. Everyone familiar with those processes? We're familiar with those processes? Good. So we employ those processes based on the type of heat that the utensil or the utensils that we allow one to kosher have been in contact with heat. So the ones who have been in contact with heat in a very serious way, like directly through heat, requires a libun gomor or a libun kal. And then hagala and others, it depends, again, on the intensity of the heat sources. So with that in mind, let's go through the various ways of koshering. So in the handout that I have for you on pages 4 and 5, Koshering for Pesach, there's a short summary of the Koshering for Pesach. And I want to, and there's a more elaborate summary that I explained to you that's from the CRC website that is, you know, again, from page 17 through 23. But let's use this one as just a point of departure. Okay? Koshering arranged. Let's start with koshering an oven. The first and most important thing that people should realize about ovens now is that the ovens actually sometimes vent. It used to be that ovens vented to the back. Ovens now sometimes vent to the front. I don't know, you know, I'm not sure where the heights ovens are, but the bottom line is that if you look at ovens, some of the newer ovens actually vent to the front. So you could have a piece of meat cooking in the oven, and the venting, the zeya, can come into the front, and you could put your hand after, I wouldn't do this while the thing is cooking, but if you just by where the heat is venting, and you can very, very much see it, it's the back of the stovetop, there's like a grate there. You put your hand after it's cooled down, and you can wipe your hands off, and you will feel fatty fat of the meat on the stovetop. I say this to you, it has nothing to do with Pesach as much as it has to do with, you have to be careful. If you're cooking meat in the oven and you're cooking an egg with cheese on it on the back burner, you might have a halakhic problem there if the heat from the meat is entering into your frying pan. So just keep that in mind. And from a Pesach perspective, I always think that the first place you start with in koshering actually is start with the oven itself. Kosher the oven. Now, there are different types of ovens, so you have to know how to kosher them different. A self-cleaning oven is obviously the nicest type of oven to clean, because a self-cleaning oven, if you just run it through one full range, one full cycle, like a three-hour cycle, you basically incinerate it. Any of the dirt in it. Now, what you can also do is obviously the oven racks can also be koshered that way, and the stovetop racks. I would call the people who make your ovens before you do this, but I know in my house, the stovetop racks, which basically cover the whole stovetop, actually also can withstand the self-clean cycle. So I actually just put them in there, and I've actually koshered the stovetop racks and the oven in one fell swoop. Sometimes they come out a little whitish. It's not a really big deal, but it totally can stand it. So if the spider tops, the metal spider tops can stand the kosher going through a self-clean cycle, it is the best and the easiest way to do it.
You might want to, around the rim of the outer rim of the oven and out and the gasket, sometimes they don't clean so well during the cycle. An EasyLoft manufactures a product that's safe for self-cleaning ovens to clean around there. Also, especially in light of what happened last Shabbos, don't leave an oven that's gone through a self-cleaning thing, you know, unattended. It's not the time for you to go outside and do your Pesach shopping. You have an oven on self-clean mode for 3 hours. You should be around the house and don't kosher the stovetop while the oven is going through this incineration of its inside. And that's it. Now, there are some self-clean ovens that will say the racks cannot handle it. In that case, you know, you should clean the racks very well. Put them in the oven at the highest temperature, usually 550 degrees Fahrenheit for 45 minutes, and this procedure will kosher them. Most of the time, my experience has been that self-cleaning ovens, by definition, the racks will be able to contain that because people aren't taking their racks out every time they do it. There are other types of ovens. There are the continuous cleaning ovens. And on page 4 of our handout, we speak about that. Clean the oven and its shelves thoroughly with oven cleaner. Don't use it for 24 hours so you can be pugging it. Next, turn the oven up for broil for an hour and a half. If you want to use the broiler, use a disposable broiler pan tray. The regular broiler tray should be placed with the utensils, unless you're going to blowtorch it, which is something I do not recommend. Microwave. Remove the glass tray from the microwave. Clean the microwave. Let it sit for 24 hours. Put a vessel with water into the microwave. Allow the water to vaporize into steam. And the duration should be the longest time you've ever used your microwave or when the water starts boiling out of the cup that you put in there. I normally use two styrofoam cups. One normally will like basically melt away. Put two of them in there, fill with water, fogs up. I start seeing the water while it's fogging, I start seeing the water start spilling over the top of the thing and you're done. Convection ovens, which is a very fancy oven. Remove the metal plate in front of the fan. Clean that area because there's a lot of debris that's there. Make sure the oven and the racks are spotless and then turn on the oven for an hour, on high for an hour and a half. Now, I want to also point out that when you speak to your congregants or in your own house if you're koshering, before you do any of this, you should really clean the exhaust fan above it, because what will happen is sometimes there's a lot of debris up there. You're not really going to get it perfectly clean, but if you clean it really well and you put a caustic agent when you're wiping it down and stuff like that, and you wait those 24 hours, there's the begema and anything that's there, you're not going to get it where it's going to be perfect. It's too, at least I've never gotten it to be perfect. That's really enough. A warming drawer. Heat the warming drawer to the required temperature by lighting a Sterno can in the warming drawer for about 2 hours. Make sure to leave the door of the warming drawer slightly ajar so that there will be enough air to allow for combustion. A new thing, these machines that allow you to, coffee. It explains you exactly what to do. Remove the K-cup holder. Clean it very well. Do not use it for 24 hours. Pour boiling water on the K-cup holder. And then brew a kosher for Pesach cup through it. So you've gone through a whole cycle. And you basically expelled any taste that there might be if there was anything chametz. Refrigerators. People make big mistakes with refrigerators. And it costs them a lot of money. There are two types of refrigerators that you have now. You have the older refrigerators and the newer ones where the shelves are just whole shelves. And then you have the refrigerators where the shelves are like spider shelves, they're just slots. A lot of people take the refrigerators that have the slots and they just put a covering over those slots. And you can ruin all the food in your refrigerator, because the reason why those refrigerators have those slots in them is because of the fact that it circulates the air. And if you put it, if you cover the slots, you remove the circulation, and not only do you hurt the food in the refrigerator, you actually even hurt the food in the freezer. Just be very careful. The goal here is not to, you know, the experiences that I'm sharing with you are not predicated as much as congregational experiences, but I was also in charge of the Vada Kashrus that I started, known as the ORB, which at that point in time was a very small Vada Kashrus, but as one of the cooks in one of the hotels will say, Rabbi, I heard there were 600,000 Jews who left Egypt, and I think I cook for all 600,000, you know, every Passover. So the bottom line is the ORB has become a very large kashrus institution. The person I hired to run it is still running it, Rabbi Pesach Weitz, who's a very talented Rav Machshir. But the bottom line is that sometimes you'll have well-meaning mashgichim who are being overzealous, and they destroy things. The first thing they destroy on a regular basis are thermostats by using blowtorches and being blowtorch happy. They just destroy thermostats like they're going out of style. And the second thing they destroy are food. 3 days into Pesach, all the food in the refrigerator is bad. No one understands why. And it's all because of one simple thing. And that was, you bought a few extra refrigerators because the industrial-sized refrigerators weren't enough. Or you people were having siddurim on different floors, so the caterer put some smaller refrigerators on different floor with slotted stuff. The mashgiach just covered it very fast, and it caused all the food in the refrigerator to become to lose its ability to stay properly. So just clean the refrigerator out. Don't cover slotted shelves when they shouldn't be covered. It's just something to recognize. Yes.
Why does it say that the fridge and the freezer should be defrosted, or that?
I don't think it needs to be. Just be clean. I mean, if a refrigerator is defrosted, I don't really know that many that are required defrosting anymore. If a refrigerator is defrosted, it could be there are crumbs and everything else that you've left in there and stuff like that. And I think if you clean it out, it should be more than fine. I have not seen freezers in a long time that require defrosting. Again, in the Heights, there might be several still, but I'm not, yeah. Okay. So we've talked about self-cleaning ovens, continuous cleaning ovens, conventional ovens, cooktops. Now I want to discuss some other things about cooktops for a second. Glass ceramic cooktops. In many communities, you have people, especially when they don't have gas, but they have electricity. South Florida has a lot of this, so I know this just from experience. And Century Village, in particular, the Century Villages have all of these glass cooktops. They're just one piece of glass with elements embedded in the glass. Anybody have a show of hands? You've seen these cooktops? So how do you kosher a cooktop like that? It's a very hard thing to kosher. So I actually created a video, which I have harata that I actually released online somewhere, still lives somewhere online, because it really, you have to be very careful how you do it. So I'm going to mention this way, then tell you don't do this. I want to just mention it to you because you can understand the logic behind it, and then tell you ways I think you should do it. Well, you have to do libun on the glass top. But how do you do, if you do libun on the glass top, if you torch it, you'll kosher your stove top in a very easy way. You'll have to buy a new one, right? So that would be the easiest way to kosher it, but you'll have to buy a new one every single year. So obviously, if you clean it down and you pour boiling hot water over it, if you turn on the stove top and you turn on the stove top for, you know, an extended, you know, 15-20 minutes. What does it say here? How to do it? Yeah, until they glow. Yeah, once they glow, it's enough. It's not even 15 minutes. Once they glow, it's enough. And the bottom line is, you know, then you're basically okay. But how do you clean the surface areas around the stove tops? So what I did was, I actually took industrial-size aluminum foil, which, by the way, you can buy in Costco or you can buy in any industrial-size aluminum foil. I cut pieces of it. I took bricks or stones, and I put them around the burners, and I created a tent out of aluminum foil, which trapped the heat. And then I took a piece of New York Times, and I rolled it as a cone. New York Times has to be good for something. Rolled it as a cone, and I just would go back and forth after a few minutes in the center of the cooktop. And sure enough, the New York Times would probably burn, right? And if you use the proper editorial comments, they'll even burn faster. So the bottom line is, you just go back and forth with it, and it burns. It singes. That's a form of Liebling, right? That's a Liebling cowl. That works. There are multiple problems with that. Number one is you really have to make sure that your tent of aluminum foil doesn't fall, because if it falls, it will enmesh into the glass and it will ruin your cooktop. Number two is you have to really have the patience to wait a little bit. And so it's halachically a good way of doing it. It's just not congregationally smart for a rabbi to inform his congregants to do it. I did that. People followed the video, were successful. But there was always one a year that didn't follow it, that whose wife was blessed with a new cooktop before Pesach. Normally the day or two before Pesach. So the bottom line is, I am not, again, I did this. It was an overzealous thing on my part, because I wanted to figure out how to do this in a halakhically correct way. And I have, somewhat of harata that I actually did it like this. Warned everybody how careful they have to be. Would go through a whole process of how to do it. But it has to be shovel the whole nefesh when you give out these types of things. It can't just be something you figure out and you'll be careful how you do it. That's an important thing to learn. So an easier way of doing it, I don't think it's this good, but it's an easier way, is that you kosher the stovetops, and then you buy trivets, and you put the trivets on the surface area, and then if you have to put a pot on it, you put it on the trivet, not on the stovetop itself, and therefore you have no halakhic problems whatsoever. It's as halakhically proper. It's not as creative as the first way, but it's a much safer way, and it's the way I would recommend that one communicates with one's congregants, unless you want to go around and kosher every ceramic cooktop in your congregation. Barbecue grills, if somebody feels the need to do that, since food is roasted directly on the grill, it must be heated to glow in order to be used. So what you would have to do is you'd have to, I think, replace the grates of the grill, or basically blowtorch the grates of the grill, and basically then take the gas grill cavity or the grill cavity and fill it with charcoal briquettes and set it on fire so that it, has this really intense fire to it. And that's a mamish Liebling to do the thing after you clean it out in 24 hours and everything else like that. But I would suggest that an easier way of doing it, if you really want a barbecue on Pesach, is just buy yourself a cheap grill for the few days that you want a barbecue on Pesach. We mentioned warming drawers, we mentioned the hood ovens and the exhaust fans, we mentioned the microwaves. Now we should just talk a little bit about kalim. I just want to mention one thing. Kalim, again, it's kabbalah kapoto. You simply, put it in boiling hot water, 15 seconds, take it out, wash it with cold water, put it down, you're good. You can use a kosher Pesach pot, you can use a non-kosher Pesach pot. I think it's better to use a kosher Pesach pot. Again, not use it for 24 hours. I've seen some very smart rabbis do something not too smart, and that is what they do is they try to help their congregants. The congregant comes to them and says, Rabbi, I didn't leave these bechers for 24 hours, and I want to kosher them. He says, no problem. He puts a little bleach in the water, so it's pogame it. And the challenge that happens is that when the silver becher comes up, it is now bleached, and it will never look as nice as it looked before it was kosher, because now it's all tinged, it's all gray. It's never going to look as nice. So here you have a guy who has his wedding bechers, and he wants to use it for Pesach, and all of a sudden he got it as a gift, koshers it because he didn't wait 24 hours. Let's say Shabbos was within 24 hours of Pesach. And he he's koshering it and stuff like that, and he you've messed up the person's bechers and stuff. Yes.
You can treat that though.
I'm sure you can treat it, but he's not voting for your next contract, right? I'm sure you can fix it, but you should learn from the mistakes that I have made, like with the tents, and the mistakes I have heard. So you don't have to make those same mistakes again. That's the purpose of this class. Learn from somebody else's mistakes. You'll make your own, but you just won't make these. Okay? Yes.
I think so. If it's on the chametz table and you're washing it with chametz and everything else like that, putting it in your dishwasher, you may have put it once in your dishwasher, I think you should kosher them. Yeah, but you kosher them, it's not a hard deal to kosher them, or you use different peppers. Again, we live in a world where these things are not as expensive as they once were, or people's disposable income is a lot larger. But if you're doing it, I would kosher. We had this like koshering fest where people, we would go to the local federation, we took over its kitchen, and we let people come for 3 hours, and you had to, and I would kosher people's stuff. And again, it's a great way to get to know people. You get these humongous pots, you kosher it very fast, and it's, and again, I'm not saying you have to do it, but you could do it in your own shul also. The other thing is, what do you do if you have a big pot that there isn't a bigger pot to kosher it in? How would you kosher that? What?
Yes,
you're doing pots. You're doing parts? Let's see another way of doing it. Great. Fill it up all the way with boiling hot water. Drop something in it. But the trick is, the stone that you drop in it can't be a cold stone, or else you'll cool down the water. So you just have to take the stone and, you know, heat it to like 200 degrees or something like that. Take it with tongs, not with your hands. Your tongs, dump it in. It will overflow, and you will kosher that very big pot. If you will be involved with hashkacha work because you live in an out-of-town community, please God, and you have the opportunity to be involved with all parts of the rabbinate, please God, you will at times deal with hashkacha stuff and stuff like that. That's a very easy way to kosher. Yes. What? You have to be careful. See, that's a mistake you'll make that hopefully none of us will make. Okay? Stainless steel sinks, Corian sinks, granite sinks, can you kosher them by putting boiling hot water on them? Start concentric circles. Start from the outside, work your way on the inside, not the opposite way. China sinks can't be koshered. Countertops, you know, the Corian sinks. Natural stone sinks can be kosher by putting boiling hot water on it. For mica sinks, you need to be concerned about the seams and things of that nature. It's best to just to put a piece of laminated plastic over it or and that's it. That's with the koshering. Anything else? We've got a little bit more to do, and we don't have that much time. But I'm open for questions on the stuff we just talked about. Okay, products. Again, I want to do halacha, and I also want to try to do like good programmatic components to this because they shouldn't be bifurcated. So I used Pesach as a wonderful way to get people more involved with kashrut, and I did grocery supermarket tours where we would do a supermarket tour, and we'd go back up and down the aisles and see which things need hashkacha, which things don't need hashkacha. You will always see people who are totally committed to Judaism, but they just have things in the refrigerator that aren't consistent with the laws of kashrut. So if they're coming for the Pesach tour, and by accident, when you pass the cheese section, you mention how cheese needs hashkacha all year round, and whether it needs it, whatever, all of a sudden you're able to communicate messages that are a little tacky to communicate when your kid happens to be over their house, you know, or something else of that nature. So, you know, Baruch Hashem, Boca Raton is a beautiful Torah community, but when our oldest son, Tovia, who you know, when there was no kosher food in Boca, my wife would make pizza at home, double wrap the pizza, and when he went to a birthday party, Tovia would have his pizza, and everybody else would have their pizza from, you know, a local non-kosher pizza place until we changed things. But the bottom line is, the kosher supermarket walking tour is a wonderful way of doing things, of just telling people. And by the way, not to be ignored, it's not a bad thing for the journal chairperson to be on the walk also, and then walk over to the kosher supermarket person and say, we're telling people to patronize your thing. I hope when we have our journal that you're going to give a nice ad. And it always works. I don't think it's appropriate for the rabbi to do, but a journal chairperson, it's a great thing. It all works together. Baby formula is always kidney out for the most of the time. It's important that the baby formula be kept maybe in a separate place when you pour in the bottles, not, you know, over your kosher Pesach stuff.
The supermarket walk I mentioned, medicines. This is a really important thing, medicines. So Rav Gedalia Schwartz, and now this is the same letter every year. The only difference with this letter is that Rabbi Yonah Reese is now on the letter. On page 10 of 56, he has a great thing reminding us that medicines, especially one with or without chametz, especially pills, can be used without checking for hashgacha. Some liquid and chewable medication may contain kidneys. I had, as I mentioned, I'm answering all the shilas from Kesher Israel right now on mikvah and other things. So yesterday I got a question about prenatal vitamins, which are definitely kidneyo. But I told her that I thought that, you know, there are vitamins that she's just swallowing, that there's no problem with them in that case. That I think prenatal vitamins, although I don't think that's true for all vitamins, that if they're kidneyo, that there wouldn't be there isn't an issue. That's true with certain cosmetics and toiletries that are, you know, shampoos and ointments and nail polishes, you know, all those wonderful things don't require kosher l'Pesach. Liquid stuffs do. Now here it mentions that toothpaste may contain chametz. You have to be concerned. Rabbi Soloveitchik was not of the opinion that toothpaste is not roi l'achilas kalav. There's a famous joke that happened when I was in a shir. Rabbi Soloveitchik made this comment that chametz is, you know, he would do something real in depth before Pesach, and then once in a while he would answer people's questions at the end. So someone asked him about toothpaste, and he said toothpaste is not roi l'achilas kalav. Laura Holteris, there was this stray dog. Someone took out some toothpaste, and the dog ate it, licked it up. The next day, the kid comes back to share. He says, Rebbe, I tested out this thing, and toothpaste is roi l'achilas kalav. He told the story, and the Rebbe turns to him and says, who are you going to believe, me or the dog, whether something's roi l'achilas kalav? That's the story. So you take it for what you want. There is a great app that the CRC put out. It is a great app. I use this app a lot this year to answer questions from Washington. It's called CRC Kosher. It is a very usable app. It gets updated every single time you click on it, so they're adding new stuff to it all the time. And you can search on anything that you want. If you're dealing with your own personal things or for, you know, the Shank Minion and stuff like that, and people asking you questions, this is just a great app. You can search on it. It has beverages, food lists, liquor. Hopefully you're not getting some of those questions. Passover, 2015, like other things. And you can just search. It's just easy to use. And I would really suggest that you just download the app. CRC Kosher. Doesn't cost anything, and it's a great app. While quinoa has been a debate, it seems like everyone's basically come to the conclusion that it's not a kidneys issue, but it needs to be certification for kosher Pesach because maybe the way where it was processed, no different than, like, example, fresh juices require kosher Pesach as the way they're processed. Cosmetics, there's a conversation, and we talked about cosmetics. Pet foods, this has become the newest thing, pet foods. So if you turn to pages 28 through 29 for a handout, you will see a wonderful CRC summary of kosher pet foods. And I don't think I have to go into any depth on this other than to tell you there's a wonderful summary here. And the Star K has one also that I thought was very nice. So I put it in here also, pages 53 to pages 56. Have your handout. The Star K has also on the laws of different products that you can use for pets. And again, it's a great guide, and you should just know that it exists. And again, page 53 to page 56. Finally, I want to focus on something that I think is as important as the stuff we've discussed in the past, and that is, you know, when I was in Boca, a lot of the young families would either go away or their parents, especially in a year like this, would come to Boca. And a lot of the parents had challenges of diabetes, right? And Pesach can be a nightmarish holiday for someone with diabetes, especially the Seders. Why? Because the two major issues of diabetes is carbs and sugars, which are part of carbs. right? So how do you deal with those issues? And most of the time, no one's ever going to come over to you and say, Rabbi, I'm a diabetic, I need guidance. So these are the type of things that you should just mention between Mincha and Maariv, or mention when you're reviewing the halachas of Pesach. Just put it in there. Worst case scenario, it doesn't apply to anybody. But I promise you, you know, that it will apply to certain people. And therefore, I ask you to turn to page 47 of our handout, and I want to share with you some things. And at Rabbi Orlin's request, because I did this once before, I actually brought in some show and tell for this. Okay. So the first thing is that best matzah for diabetics is whole wheat matzah, simply because whole wheat matzah, the way the carbs, again, I'm way past my knowledge base, but the way carbs are processed, because of the way the flour is, it's a different type of flour. The carbs are significantly less. Whole wheat matzah will be like a significant less amount of carbs than regular matzah. So diabetics should use whole wheat matzah. The second thing is there are minimum shears and maximum shears. Rav Heinemann has put together this wonderful chart on page 73, which gives you the various achila minimum shiurim, and it really makes a difference because you can get six carbs for a hand matzah piece versus 12 carbs, and again, you don't just eat matzah once through the meal. You're talking about a significant difference in the amount of carbs, and there was never a Pesach in Boca Raton that I didn't have to deal with the issue of post-Seder of somebody's parent going to the hospital for something, and many of the times it was because of diabetic issues. There was never a Pesach in like 15 years that I didn't have to deal with this issue. So I'm more sensitive about this issue. I'm just pointing it out to you, but you should be sensitive about it for your police God, for your communities. And if that wasn't enough, the carbs from the thing, you have carbs from wine. You have sugar from wine. So I borrowed this meter from a neighbor, showed me how to use it, and I actually went to a liquor store and did a little research, and I want to show you a few things. Grape juice. Now, this is not made to measure wines. It's made to measure your blood, right? Normal blood is like 100. After you eat, maybe it goes up more, maybe 140, 150, or something like that. You can check, you can Google yourself what it should be. But it's a tester for blood. So obviously, the testing that it'll give for this is different. So this is grape juice. So when I test the grape juice, excuse my lack of... 5 seconds. 343 it measures on this. I assume that is not good for a diabetic, okay? You don't need to be a doctor to know that. 343. So, what do we learn from that? We do not encourage diabetics to drink grape juice.
I don't like grape juice.
What?
I don't like grape juice.
I'm sure I like grape juice. This has 25 grams of sugar. Light grape juice probably has like 20 grams, or 19.
Kind of light grape juice has 2/3 less calories.
So then I think that almost probably would be better. All right, so that would be great. But I'm actually going to make. You should check. Listen, just check. Milsa Dafshel Levure. We don't have to have an argument about it. Okay. Now this is a dry wine. We're going to pour a little into this dry wine. And we're going to do the same thing. Twenty-nine versus, what was that, like 3-something? Okay. Now, here's the great thing about this. This has 12.5% alcohol. 12.5. Halachically, you only need 4% alcohol, which means you can create, a diabetic can create their own special reserve wine by pouring, if this is 12% and you dilute it to 4%, you're still yotzei all the shitas. And if this was only 29 grams with it full, imagine what it is with it much less. And all of a sudden, you can just, again, mix it before Yantif, not at the Seder. But at if this is 12%, it's 12.9, but let's round it off again to 12. It's 12%, so you can basically, you can get this down to 4%, and you can put in two-thirds water, one-third wine, and all of a sudden, this is going to go down significantly more. Now this, I took this from my, these are from Mishalach Manos from, like, you know, a few weeks ago. These are from, now this wine is a dry wine, so the semi-sweets are obviously going to have more sugar than 29, but less than is probably 300. This is the Moscato.
The blue bottle?
The blue bottle, yes. Blue bottle. Let's put this in here. Blue bottle. 350. Okay?
More than the grape juice.
Right.
It makes sense because it's soda.
It makes sense because it's soda. Right, but not diet soda. Okay? So here's my point. My point is that you can do this two ways. If a diabetic has 4 cups of this, their challenge is that night versus 4 diluted cups of this, the challenges are totally different. They're just totally different challenges. And there's no reason in the world that we shouldn't accommodate a diabetic in order to make sure that there's no pikuach nefesh issues that are going on. There's just no reason for it. Now, not everyone can drink wine. So Rav Heinemann here has, on page 75, the diluting of wine and grape juice with water. So he has this whole thing about how you can dilute it. I've read more of the wine piece, but it's all here for you. And if you assume one has wine with 10% alcohol content, you can do a 40-60 mix because you can get another 4%. He speaks about the different wines. He speaks about the different grape juices. When mixing grape juice with water, at least 50% of the mixture should be regular grape juice. If you're using a lighter one. But he goes through the different ones. He speaks about Kedem Concord grape juice. It scored 16 grams of carbs in 4 ounce serving. That's probably significantly less than what we saw. And a diabetic can create their own special reserve.
What?